This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Good morning and welcome into another edition of Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. My name is Alex Streamer. I have a couple of interviews lined up for you today. First up, we have Michelle Wood. She is the media chair for the Boston Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. She's also the co-chair of their National Volunteer Advisory Council. PanCAN, as it's dubbed, is holding its 8th annual Boston Purple Stride, Boston 2018 event on November the 4th. It's at the Boston Common. The goal is to raise $565,000 to help cure pancreatic cancer and continue to spread awareness. I did not know this, but in preparing for the interview, I read a number of articles about pancreatic cancer and just how deadly it is. It is the third leading cause of cancer-related death in the United States, next to breast cancer and lung cancer. And by 2020, they project it's going to be number one. So that is incredible, especially considering, again, I'm not sure many people, and I'll include myself in this category, really know much about pancreatic cancer, even what the symptoms are, how it affects you, or where your pancreas is. So Michelle Wood from PanCAN, I think a really informative interview. Certainly we'll get to that. And then also coming up later in the show, a bit of a current event conversation. You know, we like to do these from time to time. Ralph Cipriani is an investigative reporter who's covered high-profile cases such as big city political corruption and sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. He's the author of a book called Target, the Senator, a Story of a Power and the Abuse of Power. That story investigates the fall and conviction of Vincent Fumo, who is formerly regarded as the most powerful politician in Pennsylvania. Ralph is Pennsylvania-based. Ralph's thesis is that prosecutors continually use the media to target defendants and make them guilty in the court of public opinion before they go to trial. I asked Ralph about his personal experiences as an investigative reporter and why investigative reporters and journalists in general don't seem to vet prosecutors like they vet other subjects of theirs. And we also go on to talk about some current event stories, including the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the Mueller investigation. Ralph and I have some disagreements about how some of this stuff played out, but still a good conversation. I think a good reminder that, in general, if you're in our position as a news reporter, news gatherer, it's so important to vet your sources. It's so important to vet your subjects and to not take information at face value. And it's so tempting to do that across the board because it's a juicy story and we got to get the story. We got to get the clicks. We got to get the ratings on TV, but you know, we're chasing the profit instead of the actual truth in some of these cases. So interesting conversation, nonetheless, with Ralph Cipriani. That is coming up as well inside this edition of Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. Thank you, as always, for listening. And welcome back to Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. In the phone lines right now, we have Michelle Wood. She is the media chair for the Boston Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. She's also the co-chair for the National Volunteer Advisory Council. Michelle, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Yes, and you are on this week because Purple Stride Boston 2018 will be held in a couple weeks on November 4th at the Boston Common. This is the 8th year that you guys are holding the event. The goal is to raise $65,000. First off, for those who don't know, tell us about Purple Stride 2018 and why it's such an important event.
Sure. Purple Stride Boston is our fundraising one-mile walk for the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network.
Okay.
This is our 8th year hosting the event. It is a family-friendly event where we have lots of survivors and caregivers come out to celebrate our survivors and raise money to help improve the statistics for pancreatic cancer.
Excellent, excellent. Now, you started with PanCAN in 2010. What propelled you to join the organization?
I actually lost my father to pancreatic cancer in 2007. He was diagnosed in 2006, lived just about 6 months to the day.
Wow.
And it was a cancer at the time that I had never heard of. And Googling it and finding on WebMD the statistics were pretty dismal, propelled me to do something more for others so that they wouldn't have to go through the same thing.
Wow, that is amazing. So only 6 months after his diagnosis. That is incredible. Right. Is that the, what's the average, if you know, is that the average? I mean, I know it obviously varies depending on which stage, but that seems awfully quick.
It is awfully quick. Generally, patients are diagnosed with, by the time they're stage four. They're diagnosed late because it's not easy to detect. So the average life expectancy is between 6 and 18 months.
Okay, so most, so the average gets diagnosed, excuse me, when it's stage four, and you said that's because the symptoms are often undetectable?
Right, they're very vague. Backache, abdominal pain, and they could be a number of different GI issues and often are misdiagnosed. My father was actually misdiagnosed with diverticulitis a few times before they found his tumors.
Wow. And for those who don't know as well, you know, pancreatic cancer, it is now the third leading cause of cancer-related death in the U.S. behind breast cancer and lung cancer. But I still don't think a lot of people know exactly what it is. So for those who don't know, what exactly is pancreatic cancer?
So you have an organ in the center of your body called the pancreas, which creates insulin for your body. Some people know we have pancreases. A lot of people actually don't. But it's kind of right in the middle of your abdomen, so it's very hard to see on scans and different tests and can often be masked thinking it's abdominal or stomach pain. And this is tumors that are within the pancreas itself.
Wow. So you mentioned, I just mentioned those pretty harrowing statistics. Given all that, where do you think we are with pancreatic cancer awareness in the United States, and what do we need to do to put it more in the forefront?
I think that more and more people in the United States are becoming aware of what pancreatic cancer is. We definitely need to get the risk factors and the symptoms out there to the general public, as well as getting local physicians to understand that this is a possibility given certain symptoms that patients might present with and that they should dig a little deeper if things just aren't seeming quite right. That being said, when I started volunteering in 2010, the survival rate was only 4% over 5 years, so only 4% of our patients survived for 5 years or more. Currently, we're actually at 9%. Not good enough yet, obviously, but it's a significant jump over the last several years, directly as an impact of a lot of the work that the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network has done nationwide.
Yeah, that's nearly double. Mentioned still a long way to go, but at least some positive signs there. So to go back to the symptoms, you mentioned your father was experiencing some backache, or that's a typical symptom. What are some signs to look out for if you think you may be suffering from this?
Definitely look out for abdominal or lower back pain, weight loss, any jaundice, which is a yellowing of the skin or the eyes, a loss of appetite, nausea. And another interesting connection that they've recently started studying more of is a recent onset diabetes. There is a study going on currently that thinks older adults that have a new diagnosis of diabetes, that may actually be a first symptom of the pancreatic cancer.
Wow, that's very, very, very interesting. And you mentioned the improvements that have been made in survival rate since you joined in 2010. For those wondering, where does the money go? If I want to donate to PanCan, where is my money going exactly?
That money goes to support multiple different ways that we're trying to attack this disease. Number one is we have research grants that we issue to outstanding research in the field, particularly looking at early detection, symptoms, better treatments. And we also have a patient support hotline. It's called Patient Central, which is free to patients and caregivers and doctors. And they can provide you with a number of different resources from symptom management to clinical trial database. We have a Know Your Tumor database as well, where you can have your tumors molecularly profiled so you know exactly what type of treatment should work for your pancreatic cancer. And this is all free to patients, doctors, and caregivers.
And you mentioned the improvements we've had in awareness over the last several years. Do you know what improvements have you made in terms of treatment with pancreatic cancer over the last, you know, how many ever years?
So since I started volunteering, there's actually been several new treatments available and approved by the FDA available to patients. The Know Your Tumor database is a huge step forward in that area. And being able to look at what makes up a particular tumor helps us understand what type of treatment would make sense for that particular patient. So not every pancreatic cancer is exactly the same. If they can find a mutation that has caused your cancer, there are various different treatments that work better with different mutations. So we're seeing a significant improvement in success on these treatments for these patients that have gone through Know Your Tumor.
Wow, and that's all based off a database? How does that work exactly?
Yes, there's a database that they keep. We have a scientific and medical advisory board with a lot of doctors and extremely smart people working on this. There's a database that they manage, and there's a third-party company that actually does the profiling of your tumor. So when you have your biopsy done, you just have tissue sent to this company, and they will go through and do that analysis for you, and they'll send it back to your doctor so you and your doctor can sit down and look at what your best options are.
Wow, that is great. We mentioned earlier, Michelle, that it is the third largest cancer killer besides breast cancer and lung cancer, but by 2020, you project it's going to be number two?
Yes. The American Cancer Society has come out with reports this last several years that cancer deaths are actually declining. Unfortunately for pancreatic cancer, it's the outlier, and that's not true. We are seeing increased rates of pancreatic cancer, and due to all the awareness that breast cancer has received and the amazing job they've done with their fundraising, their survival rates are going up.
Right. And why are diagnoses going up? Is it just because more people are aware of it?
It is more people are aware of it. It's becoming more common. Some of the risk factors include, diabetes, smoking, obesity, which are things that the United States struggle with in general.
Right. Right. Yes. Yes. So would you say that, so diabetes can lead to pancreatic cancer, or does pancreatic cancer cause diabetes?
So the research is being done right now to see the late onset adult diabetes and new cases of it are looking to be about 1 in 100 cases potentially could be that's the first symptom of the pancreatic cancer. There's still a lot of research being done in this area. Not being a doctor, I don't want to mislead anybody on that information.
Sure, of course not. So what's the next big goal you'd like to see accomplished here, Michelle, with pancreatic cancer awareness and or treatment?
Well, our goal as an organization is to double the survival rate by 2020. So we'd like to see that 9% survival rate over 5 years become closer to 12. That would certainly be our number one goal. Awareness is certainly the biggest factor out there. I would love it to be cured. That is obviously our ultimate goal, but we have little ways to go for that still.
And we can start or continue this process with the Purple Stride Boston 2018 Walk being held on November 4th at Boston Common. Eighth year of the event is being held. Goal is to raise $65,000. Where are you folks in regards to that goal right now?
Our goal is actually $565,000.
Oh, okay, I misspoke. Right. Okay, even better. Where are you in regards to that?
We are about 45% on the way to our goal. We're a little over $260,000 raised.
And if folks want to donate and help out, how can they do that?
They can contact us at pancan.org/Boston to get in touch with the affiliate or to make a donation. It's purplestride.org and just search for the Boston event.
Okay, $565,000. Let's get them to that figure. Michelle Wood, she's the media chair for the Boston Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, also the co-chair of their National Volunteer Advisory Council. Michelle, thanks for taking some time coming on the show and best of luck with the walk in a couple of weeks.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And welcome back to Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. On the phone line right now, we have Ralph Cipriano. He's an investigative reporter who's covered high-profile cases such as big city political corruption and sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and at Penn State. He is the author of Target the Senator, a story about power and the abuse of power that investigates the fall and conviction of Vincent Fumo, who is formerly regarded as the most powerful politician in Pennsylvania. Ralph, how are you? Thanks for taking some time and coming on.
Alex, it's a pleasure to be here.
Great to speak with you. So your thesis with this book, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that your thesis in general, one of your main talking points, is that prosecutors use the media to target defendants and make them guilty in the court of public opinion before they go to trial. Before we go any further, is that correct? Do I have your viewpoint accurate?
You got it.
Yes, okay. So I guess the first question is, how does this generally happen? How does this process generally work?
Well, Alex, I didn't know anything about this topic at all. 10 years ago, I was asked to cover legal cases for a legal blog in town. And so I started covering the cases. I figured the prosecutors were the good guys. And then I just watched them lie and cheat and leak. And, you know, it just happened in case after case. I've seen them send innocent men to jail. I've seen them bend the rules. So I've just come to the conclusion that, you know, nobody watches these guys. The media usually gets in bed with them because it's a good story. And they don't hold them accountable. How they do it is they usually buddy up to the press or have a wonderful working relationship with the press. And they leak out their allegations. And they leak out enough of it so that, and, you know, a continual stream of leaks, so that by the time the accused goes on trial, he's already been convicted in the court of public opinion. That's how it's done.
Right. And you encountered this during your work as an investigative reporter?
Just covering court cases.
Yep.
You know? And it's a real eye-opener when you've seen it unfold in front of you.
What's the most memorable example that you can recall seeing in your career?
Well, we all know, you certainly know in Boston, that the Catholic Church was guilty of molesting lots of young children and raping them. And the bishops were really good at systematically covering it up. Well, our district attorney in Philadelphia managed to find, I don't know how he did it, since we've got thousands of real victims wandering around the city, but he happened to pick a junkie fraudster who was nicknamed Billy Doe by a grand jury, and he claimed he was raped by two priests and a school teacher passed around amongst them and raped repeatedly. And he sent all three, the two priests and a school teacher, to jail, and they sent the administrator who was supposed to watch over these guys to jail. He was the first administrator in the country to go to jail in the Catholic Church, not for touching anybody, but for covering it up. And his entire story was made up. And one of the priests who went to jail, falsely accused, died there, handcuffed to a hospital bed, still professing his innocence, you know, with his dying breath. So it was watching all that happen was a real eye-opener to me.
That's incredible. And as you mentioned, there are so many real victims or survivors of the abuse. Why is it just greed? Is it hubris? Why go forward with false stories when there are so many real and harrowing ones?
Well, the problem here, and I think of the same thing happened in Boston, was so many of these crimes happened outside of the statute of limitations.
Right, long time ago, yep.
They happened so long ago. So the heat was on when people finally, it became public what the Catholic Church had done. You know, everybody was pissed off about it and said somebody should pay. The problem is we were down to only a few alleged victims that fit into the statute of limitations. And this, our district attorney, who wound up in jail for federal corruption charges on other matters, he, you know, cut some corners and went ahead with a couple of fraudsters when he had to know there were all sorts of problems. And the whole thing got blown open when the district attorney's own lead detective came forward to lay the whole thing out and saying, this kid, you know, is a liar. I caught him in one lie after another. And when I confronted him before trial, he admitted to me that he made it up. So that's a pretty sad story.
Very sad. And again, it just totally undermines the case because, like here in Boston, there are so many real survivors of the abuse. It takes away from their stories. It's pretty sick.
I totally agree with you on that point. That was always the point I made. And the sad thing was, this guy by the name of Billy Doe, whose real name is Danny Gallagher, and I wrote a couple of cover stories about him that you can find for Newsweek. You know, he not only did he put these guys in jail, but he collected $5 million from the Catholic. And so, you know, that money should have gone to real victims, and I sure as hell know enough of them.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Ralph. So why do you think that the media and journalists get played by these overzealous prosecutors? Because I especially look at the climate we're in now with social media and Twitter. I feel like access journalism is to blame, where everybody wants a scoop. Everyone wants the inside scoop. And because there's so much news now, you know, everything is ephemeral. It goes out in the air and then floats away, so that there's a lack of accountability, too. So I blame the climate of access journalism, but obviously this has been happening well before now. So what's your current read on this current environment and why journalists don't seem to vet a lot of these prosecutors?
Oh, boy. I could go on all day.
I know. Long topic. We have time.
I could go on all day about this. Yeah. The short version is that there's a lot of, well, Alex, you know all about this, but I mean, there's a lot of groupthink in journalism. I mean, you can't find it more homogenous people who all vote the same, read the same things, think the same opinions. You know, so there's, when I was, you know, in the ancient years when I was first practicing journalism, at the LA Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer, yeah, we had a lot of crackpots in the newsroom that, you know, were contrarians, and that sort of spirit has gone right out. I would just say, sadly, that we don't hold prosecutors accountable. They come with to the press with great stories of, you know, evil deeds and terrible crimes and terrible people, but the press just doesn't go the extra mile to vet all of that.
Because the story's just too good.
Yeah, well, it is too good, but and they don't do any follow-up on it, you know? So that's the sad part of it. We're just not doing our jobs as journalists. I mean, we don't vet presidential candidates, and we don't vet prosecutors, you know?
We're talking with Ralph Cipriano here in Boston Community Affairs, a investigative reporter. Ralph, so let's tie it to some current events. Are there any recent high-profile examples of this that come to mind that have been in the news?
Well, you know, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, I mean, it's impossible on an old, you know, an old cases like that. It was irresponsible to put Dr. Ford up there. I mean, her case should have been vetted behind closed doors. She should have been granted the anonymous, you know, role that she wanted. I mean, that was just a travesty. And once you get these cases out there, they're impossible to defend. So I thought that was a sad case of the press running with allegations, and, you know, by the time, I don't think Kavanaugh will ever be the same, you know.
Well,
God help him if he was innocent.
Well, I mean, he got to the Supreme Court. Let's, you know.
He did get there.
Does that feel too bad for him?
No, that's true, but I'm just saying, you know, it just wasn't the right way to determine the truthfulness of any of those allegations. That should have been done by real investigators, and you know, we shouldn't have been throwing allegations up there. We should have had an investigation and come forward with the results of that investigation.
Right. And and what Dr. Ford said at the time was, so she contacted her congresswoman in July,
yeah,
and she wanted to be anonymous, as you mentioned. And once it started leaking out, she spoke and said, well, if my story's out there, I might as well tell it in my own words. So you can't blame her for going public once her story got leaked, correct?
I'm not blaming her for anything.
Right.
No. I just don't think it was handled responsibly all the way along. You know, those allegations should have been, you know, investigated way before they ever had Kavanaugh, you know, under the lights. I mean, that's the way that one should have played. And I got to say, with the Mueller investigation, you know, we just get pieces, sort of like the Clinton investigation, you know, where they started off investigating.
Right.
Bill Clinton for Whitewater, and we ended up with Monica.
Lewinsky.
And, you know, we start off with collusion with Trump, and we end up with Stormy Daniels. I mean, that's, you know, and all of the details are leaked to the press and the allegations and stuff like that. And it just doesn't ever seem to me to be ever, anything is ever fully investigated, and we're just moving on to the next story and the next story after that.
Well, I think it's a couple things. I mean, in terms of that, you know, the Stormy Daniels, I mean, it did turn out, though, Michael Cohen had the tapes, not to get too in the weeds, that, you know, Trump did seem to direct him to commit a federal crime, you know, campaign fraud, about, you know, the payment to Stormy Daniels would have been a campaign contribution. So we did get something there. But you're right, from the standpoint that I feel like, especially in regards to Russia and Mueller and collusion, it's just such a juicy topic for the media to explore, right? It sounds dark, it sounds dangerous that, you know, and the focus on it, too. My issue has been there's so much to cover with the Trump presidency. Let's just let this investigation play out and focus on the actual tangible stuff that we have in front of us.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And, hey, who doesn't love, you know, a face-off between a porn star and the president? I mean, you know, every reporter in the universe would love that story. But I'm just saying, we, as far as collusion and Russiagate and all that stuff, I don't know. Do you feel you know what happened? I sure don't.
No, not the extent of it. I mean, I feel a lot of people in Trump's orbit seem to have communications with Russians and seem to lie about it a lot. We also had a lot of convictions, which, as you mentioned, Manafort and stuff, not really with the Russian collusion. That's been more financial crimes, which I guess, you know, correlates to the Clinton investigation, where he started with Whitewater, he went to Alinsky, and we have these free-wielding special prosecutors. But in general, Ralph, you know, I think again, speaks to the fact that in the media, we're just so hungry for the scoop, so hungry for the story. So, and, you know, ratings as well, right? I mean, network news is a ratings-fueled industry. And I think the moment a lot of this happened when that's what started, when we started viewing news as a profit driver. You know, it used to be in the old days, I learned about this, news used to be a loss for these networks, and they were fine with that. So the moment, though, that news became a profit driver, I think you started to see a lot of this sensational stuff and maybe not as much vetting as we saw previously.
Right. Totally agree with that. But, you know, when I went to journalism school, we were told the old-fashioned credo was to hold everyone accountable. And, you know, in my mind, that includes, you know, presidents, prosecutors, right, and everybody. I mean, we just, so, you know, Bill Belichick, we don't hold him accountable, right? So it's...
We do, yes. We're still talking about the Malcolm Butler Super Bowl benching. So.
Yeah. But we never got the straight story.
Never got it.
He never owned up to it, did he?
No, of course not, and he never will. That's how he rolls. So yeah. What does the future look like, Ralph, then, in this climate? Do we sense this changing, or what do you see the next few years, then, like?
Well, you know, it's really funny because so many platforms are out there, and they want their news, you know, in paragraphs and easily digestible items. I've been sort of going the other way with, like, this book that I wrote about, you know, Target the Senator. And on my blog, bigtrial.net, I've run a lot of in-depth stuff, especially about, like, what happened at Penn State and the Catholic Church. Oh, God, I spent years writing about the Catholic Church, both for and against them, their horrendous crimes, and then when the wrong guys got sent to jail, I spent a lot of time on that. And I find, and I don't know how to explain this, because I can tell you editors aren't looking for this stuff, but it seems like readers are genuinely happy when they find something in depth that, you know, doesn't seem to have a definite point of view, but is, you know, just like some guy like me trying to find out what the hell really happened. It's work. So, I mean, there are stories that I put on the blog that I've gotten like 50,000 hits on in a day, you know, which really leaves me mystified as to what the hell is going on when I can't peddle them to any editor in town.
Right. But hey, that's the beauty about the internet age, right? People, there's good content,
absolutely,
good reporting. People will find it. Real quick, Ralph, you mentioned Penn State. What kind of reporting did you do on that story, and how does this tie into what we're discussing?
It's so distressing, Alex. I mean, you know, look, I wasn't there when it first happened, but I've since seen reams of documents in that case. And that case is so tainted with official misconduct that I question everything they've told us. I mean, we've had prosecutors guilty of all the tactics I was telling you about, illegal leaks from the grand jury and trampling on the constitutional rights of the people they were pursuing. We had the cops caught lying on tape to the people they were interviewing to get the stories they want out of them. We had psychiatrists using scientifically discredited memory recovery therapy to get things out of the victims, to send Jerry Sandusky, who is quite a whack job himself, off to jail. The list of official misconduct in the case goes on and on. And the Board of Trustees gave out $118 million to 36 alleged victims of Jerry Sandusky, and near as I can tell from all the documents I've looked at, without asking a single question of any of these guys, most of whom were allowed to remain anonymous. They could and come up with the craziest stories you can imagine. So there was just no accountability, lots of official misconduct, and you've got a Board of Trustees that is still covering up everything as we speak, and I've written a lot about that. So it leaves you, it's hard to have any public confidence in what what's regarded as the story out there, the official storyline. It's hard to have any official confidence in it once you've seen all misconduct on there.
Yeah, and that would seem to tie into the Catholic Church situation where, you know, the actual gruesome crimes or alleged crimes are bad enough, you know, but then you have to add on with the misconduct and and whatnot. But that's for another time. Ralph Cipriani, he's an investigative reporter who's covered high-profile cases, big city political corruption, sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, author of the book Target, The Senator, Story About Power, and the Abuse of Power. Ralph, thanks so much for coming on the show. Much appreciated.
Alex, it was a pleasure. Thanks for being so well-prepared.
Great. Thank you. Thank you again for tuning in to another edition of Boston Community Affairs here in WEI, and thanks to our guests Michelle Wood and Ralph Cipriani for joining us this week. Before we go, a couple weeks ago we spoke to Jessica Tepro from Reach Beyond Domestic Violence. I would like to make you aware that as part of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, three members of Reach's Survival Speakers Bureau will be speaking on a panel at Boston Public Library next Thursday evening. It's sure to be an inspiring and moving experience. For more information, head to bpl.bibliocommons.com and go to the events tab. Thank you for listening. As always, much appreciated. We'll talk to you next week.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.